Now it's my great pleasure to introduce our partner in this series from the National Book Foundation, Harold Ogenbaum, who is the Executive Director of the National Book Foundation, and he'll say a little bit about the program and introduce our guests this evening. So thank you and enjoy.
Thank you, Suzanne, and thank you everybody for coming on a kind of a cold night out there. It's nice to be in here where it's warm, and I appreciate all of you coming. One of the things that I do as the executive director of the National Book Foundation is I recruit the judges for the panels that read during the summer. They get about 2 months, and they read between 175 and 540 books in about a two-month period. So just to give you an example of what my week has been like, and I know you're all interested in that, that's why I'm here. That's why you've come. You really didn't want to see Jonathan Franzen. You came here because you knew Harold Ogenbaum was going to tell you what his week was like. My week was calling people on the phone, people who were, you know, these wonderful writers across the country, and saying to them, you know, I love your work. Would you be a judge for the National Book Award this year? And they inadvertently say to me, well, what exactly do I have to do? And I explained to them how it goes from now until November 14th when we give out the National Book Awards. And then I wait until the very end, and I wait until they ask me, and they say, well, how many books do I have to read? And my first impulse is to say, well, let's not worry about that now. But my favorite part is when I get to the nonfiction panelists, the potential panelists, and they say, how many books do I have to read? And I said, well, in the old days, we used to get about 400 books that you'd have to read between June 15th and September 1st. And they say, yeah, but that was the old days. How many do I have to read now? And they say, well, the last couple of years, it's been 540. That's when the coughing starts, and most of the time they hang up. But you know, usually they're very good about it. But what I really wanted to bring out with that is that these are the books that the publishers send to us because they believe that these are the best books that they've published this year. And I think that from our point of view of the National Book Foundation, the National Book Awards, we really think that there's a lot of great writing going on in the United States right now. And our little part in it is to recommend to you as an audience and as readers what books we think and our judges think are the best books of the year. It's not always the best book, but it's among the best books of the year. And that's really one of the things that we believe in, that this series, the purpose of this series here as well, is to bring you the best writers in America, to introduce their work to you if you've read it already, to make contact for you. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce our moderator this evening. Bridget Hughes is a wonderful editor. She's a former editor of the Paris Review, which is, of course, one of the world's great literary reviews. In the last year, she has put together what it may be the next great literary review in the United States, A Public Space. She's a terrific editor and a wonderful moderator, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Bridget Hughes.
Thank you, Harold, and thank you to everyone at the National Book Foundation and at BAM for inviting me to be part of this series. It has been an honor, and it has also been a real pleasure. I'm especially delighted to be here tonight to introduce Jonathan Franzen. When Jonathan Franzen was awarded the National Book Award for his novel, The Corrections, he was honored as one of the most astute interpreters of the American mind and spirit. And certainly through his fiction and essays, he has shaped much of the conversation about the state of literature over the past decade. Whether he's wrestling with Oprah or William Gaddis, writing about the Chicago Post Office or bird watching, or dissecting the breakdown of a family at the end of the 20th century. His most recent book, which I think he's going to read from tonight, is The Discomfort Zone, A Personal History. He also published a collection of essays, How to Be Alone, in 2002, and he's the author of two novels in addition to The Corrections, Strong Motion, and 27th City, his first novel, which was published in 1988. But his first true publication, which he mentions briefly in The Discomfort Zone, was a play written with his high school physics class, which was published in 1977 when he was 17. It's called The Fig Connections, and I thought I would just read a brief description that the publisher put together. The Fig Connections, a comedy by John Franzen and Kathy Siebert, cast 8 men, 2 women, 6 spies. In this wild espionage spoof, the Russians are out to capture the English scientist Sir Isaac Newton, who is about to invent a secret weapon, gravity. a fast-moving play that deals with no moral dilemma or social issues. Late in the fall, a publisher bought Fig Connections for $100, he writes in the essay centrally located, and I told my parents I was going to be a writer. They weren't happy to hear it. Fortunately for us, he paid them no mind, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Jonathan Franzen to BAM.
Thank you for coming. I don't know what to say. It's hard to read in New York, actually. It's like, this is like Manhattan, only worse. No, it's hard to read at home. It's easy to be away. Anyway. And also, one is accustomed to sort of this orientation of an audience so that you can more or less, within the scan of your eyes, see everyone. And it's a very strange sense to have, be able to see like 12 of you and to be stared at intently by everyone who I'm unable to see. Just, they asked me to read between 15 and 20 minutes, and even though we are running a little late, I'm going to do that, and we will not be offended if you leave at 9 if you have to. But I think we'll probably go a little past that just to make sure I feel you've gotten your money's worth. My publisher since 1987, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, would like me to repeat the title of the book I'm going to read from. It is called The Discomfort Zone. It's available in a handsome package in bookstores today. I'm going to read two short sections from the last chapter, and I hope the context will emerge. The context is basically global warming, sudden, late blooming obsession with birds of mine, trying to understand what happened to a long marriage that I was no longer in, and lurking beneath that some questions about elitism and how actually to fashion a rhetoric. If you care about the environment but don't want to sound like people who care about the environment, it's a devil of a problem, really. Anyway, I'm going to read the fourth and the fifth section, mainly because they add up to a, I think, 17-minute reading. And I haven't read them very much. A staple of my family's dinner table conversation in the mid-70s was the divorce and remarriage of my father's boss at the railroad, Mr. German. Nobody of my parents' generation and either of their extended families had ever been divorced, nor had any of their friends. And so the two of them steeled each other in their resolve not to know Mr. German's young second wife. They exhaustively pitied the first wife, quote, poor Gloriana, who had been so dependent on her husband that she'd never even learned to drive. They expressed relief and worry at the Germans' departure from their Saturday night bridge club, since Mr. German was bad at bridge, but Gloriana was now left without a social life. One night, my father came home and said he'd almost lost his job that day at lunch. In the executive dining room, while Mr. German and his subordinates were discussing how to assess a person's character, my father had found himself remarking that he judged a man by how he played a bridge hand. I wasn't old enough to understand that he hadn't really almost lost his job for this, or that condemning Mr. German and pitying Gloriana were ways for my parents to talk about their own marriage. But I did understand that dumping your wife for a younger woman was the sort of despicable, selfish thing that a chronic overbitter might do. A related talk staple in those years was my father's hatred of the Environmental Protection Agency. The young agency had issued complicated rules about soil pollution and toxic runoff and riverbank erosion, and some of the rules seemed unreasonable to my father. What really enraged him, though, were the enforcers. Night after night, he came home fuming about these bureaucrats and these academics, these high-handed so-and-sos, who didn't bother to hide how morally and intellectually superior they felt to the corporations they were monitoring, and who didn't think they owed explanations or even basic courtesy to people like my dad. The odd thing was how closely my father's values resembled those of his enemies. The breakthrough environmental legislation of that era, including the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts and the Endangered Species Acts, had attracted the support of President Nixon and both parties in Congress precisely because it made sense to old-fashioned Protestants, like my parents, who abhorred waste and made sacrifices for their kids' future and respected God's works and believed in taking responsibility for their messes. But the social ferment that gave rise to the first Earth Day in 1970 unleashed a host of other energies: the incivility of the so-and-sos, the pleasurable self-realizations of Mr. German, the cult of individuality, that were inimical to the old religion and ultimately won out. Certainly I, as a self-realizing individual in the 90s, was having trouble with my parents' logic of unselfishness. Deprive myself of an available pleasure, why? Take shorter and colder showers, why? Keep having anguished phone conversations with my estranged wife on the subject of our failure to have children, why? Struggle to read Henry James's last three novels, why? Stay mindful of the Amazon rainforest, why? New York City, which I returned to for good in 1994, was becoming a very pleasant place to live again. The nearby Catskills and Adirondacks were better protected than the Rockies and Cascades. Central Park, under recultivation by deep-pocketed locals, was looking greener every spring, and the other people out walking in it didn't enrage me the way they did when I ran into them in the mountains in the West. This was a city. There were supposed to be people. On a May night in 1996, I walked across the park's newly restored deep pile lawns to a party where I saw a beautiful and very young woman standing awkwardly in a corner behind a floor lamp that she twice nearly knocked over. And I felt so liberated that I could no longer remember one single reason not to introduce myself to her and, in due course, start asking her out. The old religion was finished. Without its cultural support, the environmental movement's own cult of wilderness was never going to galvanize mass audiences. John Muir, writing from San Francisco at a time when you could travel to Yosemite without hardship and still have the valley to yourself for spiritual refreshment, founded a religion that required a large parcel of empty backcountry for every worshiper. Even in 1880, there weren't enough parcels like this to go around. Indeed, for the next 80 years, until Rachel Carson and David Brower sounded their populist alarms, the preserving of wild nature was generally assumed to be the province of elites. The organization that Muir formed to defend his beloved Sierras was a club, not an alliance. Henry David Thoreau, whose feelings for pine trees were romantic, if not downright sexual, called the workers who felled them vermin. For Edward Abbey, who was the rare green writer with the courage of his misanthropy, the appeal of southeastern Utah was, frankly, that its desert was inhospitable to the great herd of Americans who were incapable of understanding and respecting the natural world. Bill McKibben, Harvard graduate, followed up his apocalyptic The End of Nature, in which he contrasted his own deep reverence for nature with the shallow-minded, quote, hobby that nature is for most outdoors people, with a book about cable TV's inferiority to the timeless pleasures of country living. To Verlaine Klinkenborg, the professional trivialist whose job is to remind New York Times readers that spring follows winter and summer follows spring, and who sincerely loves snowdrifts and baling twine, the rest of humanity is a distant blob notable for its, quote, venality and ignorance. And so, once the EPA had cleaned up the country's most glaring messes, once sea otters and peregrine falcons had rebounded from near extinction, once Americans had had a disagreeable taste of European-style regulation, the environmental movement began to look like just another special interest hiding in the skirts of the Democratic Party. It consisted of well-heeled nature enthusiasts, tree-spiking misanthropes, nerdy defenders of unfashionable values, thrift, foresight, invokers of politically unfungible abstractions, the welfare of our great-grandchildren, issuers of shrill warning about invisible risks like global warming and exaggerated hazards like asbestos in public buildings, tiresome scolds about consumerism, reliers on facts and policies in an age of image, a constituency loudly proud of its refusal to compromise with others. Bill Clinton, the first boomer president, knew a stinker when he saw one. Unlike Richard Nixon, who had created the EPA, and unlike Jimmy Carter, who had set aside 25 million acres of Alaska as permanent wilderness, Clinton needed the Sierra Club a lot less than it needed him. In the Pacific Northwest, on lands belonging to the American people, the U.S. Forest Service was spending tens of millions of tax dollars to build roads for multinational timber companies that were clear-cutting gorgeous primeval forests and taking handsome profits for themselves, preserving a handful of jobs for loggers who would soon be out of work anyway, and shipping a lot of the timber to Asia for processing and sale. You wouldn't think this issue was an automatic public relations loser, but groups like the Sierra Club decided to fight the battle out of public sight in federal court, where their victories tended to be pyrrhic. And the boomer president, whose need for love was non-satiable by Douglas firs or spotted owls, but conceivably could be met by lumberjacks, soon added the decimation of the Northwest's old-growth forests to a long list of related setbacks, an environmentally toothless NAFTA, the metastasis of exurban sprawl, the lowering of average national vehicle fuel efficiency, the triumph of the SUV, the accelerating depletion of the world's fisheries, the Senate's 95-0 demurral on the Kyoto Protocol, etc. In the decade when I left my wife and took up with a 27-year-old and really started having fun. Section break. Then my mother died, and I went out birdwatching for the first time in my life. This was the summer of 1999. I was on Hat Island, a wooded loaf of gravel subdivided for small weekend homes near the blue-collar town of Everett, Washington. There were eagles and kingfishers and Bonaparte's gulls and dozens of identical sparrows that persisted, no matter how many times I studied them, in resembling six different sparrow species in the field guide. Flocks of goldfinches brilliantly exploded up over the island's sunlit bluffs like something ceremonial and Japanese. I saw my first northern flicker and enjoyed its apparent confusion about what kind of bird it was. Unwoodpeckerish in plumage, like a mourning dove in war paint, it flew dippingly in typical woodpecker fashion, white rump flashing, from one ill-fitting identity to another. It had a way of landing with a little crash wherever. In its careening beauty, it reminded me of my former girlfriend, the one I'd first glimpsed tangling with a floor lamp and was still very fond of, though from a safe remove now. I'd since met a vegetarian Californian writer, a self-described fool for animals, slightly older than I, who had no discernible interest in getting pregnant or married or in moving to New York. As soon as I'd fallen for her, I'd set about trying to change her personality and make it more like mine. And although a year later I had nothing to show for this effort, I at least didn't have to worry about ruining somebody again. The Californian was a veteran of a ruinous marriage of her own. Her indifference to the idea of kids spared me from checking my watch every 5 minutes to see if it was time for my decision about her reproductive future. The person who wanted kids was me, and being a man, I could afford to take my time. The last day I ever spent with my mother at my brother's house in Seattle, she asked me the same questions over and over. Was I pretty sure the Californian was the woman I would end up with? Did I think we would probably get married? Was the Californian actually divorced yet? Was she interested in having a baby? Was I? My mother was hoping for a glimpse of how my life might proceed after she was gone. She'd met the Californian only once at a noisy restaurant in Los Angeles, but she wanted to feel that our story would continue and that she'd participated in it in some small way, if only by expressing her opinion that the Californian really ought to be divorced by now. My mother loved to be a part of things, and having strong opinions was a way of not feeling left out. At any given moment in the last 20 years of her life, family members in three time zones could be found worrying about her strong opinions, or loudly declaring that they didn't care about them, or phoning each other for advice on how to cope with them. Whoever imagined that "love your mother" would make a good environmental bumper sticker obviously didn't have a mom like mine. Well into the 90s, tailing Subarus or Volvos outfitted with this admonition and its accompanying snapshot of Earth, I felt obscurely hectored by it, as if the message were, "Nature wonders why she hasn't heard from you in nearly a month." Or, "Our planet strongly disapproves of your lifestyle." Or, "The Earth hates to nag, but..." Like the natural world, my mother had not been in the best of health by the time I was born. She was 38, she'd had three successive miscarriages, and she'd been suffering from ulcerative colitis for a decade. She kept me out of nursery school because she didn't want to let go of me for even a few hours a week. She sobbed frighteningly when my brothers went off to college. Once they were gone, I faced 9 years of being the last handy object of her maternal longings and frustrations and criticisms, and so I allied myself with my father, who was embarrassed by her emotion. I began by rolling my eyes at everything she said. Over the next 25 years, as she went on to have acute phlebitis, a pulmonary embolism, two knee replacements, a broken femur, three miscellaneous orthopedic surgeries, Raynaud's disease, arthritis, biannual colonoscopies, monthly blood clot tests, extreme steroidal facial swelling, congestive heart failure, and glaucoma, I often felt terribly sorry for her. I tried to say the right things and be a dutiful son. But it wasn't until she got a bad cancer diagnosis in 1996 that I began to do what those bumper stickers admonished me to do. She died in Seattle on a Friday morning. The Californian who'd been due to arrive that evening and spend some days getting acquainted with her ended up alone with me for a week at my brother's vacation house on Head Island. I broke down in tears every few hours, which I took as a sign that I was working through my grief and would soon be over it. I sat on the lawn with binoculars and watched a spotted towhee scratch vigorously in the underbrush like somebody who really enjoyed yard work. I was pleased to see chestnut-backed chickadees hopping around in conifers, since, according to the guidebook, conifers were their favorite habitat. I kept a list of the species I'd seen. By midweek, though, I'd found a more compelling pastime. I began to badger the Californian about having children and the fact that she wasn't actually divorced yet. In the style of my mother, who had been a gifted abrader of the sensitivities of people she was unhappy with, I gathered and collated all the faults and weaknesses that the Californian had ever privately confessed to me, and I showed her how these interrelated faults and weaknesses were preventing her from deciding right now whether we would probably get married and whether she wanted to have children. By the end of the week, fully 7 days after my mother's death, I was sure I was over the worst of my grief, and so I was mystified and angered by the Californian's unwillingness to move to New York and immediately try to get pregnant. Even more mystified and angered a month later when she took wing to Santa Cruz and refused to fly back. On my first visit to the cabin where she lived in the Santa Cruz Mountains, I'd stood and watched mallards swimming in the San Lorenzo River. I was struck by how frequently a male and a female paired up, one waiting on the other while it nosed in the weeds. I had no intention of living without steak or bacon, but after that trip, as a token of vegetarianism, I decided to stop eating duck. I asked my friends what they knew about ducks. All agreed that they were beautiful animals. Several also commented that they did not make good pets. In New York, while the Californian took refuge from me in her cabin, I seethed with strong opinions. The only thing I wanted was for her and me to be in the same place, and I would gladly have gone out to California if only she told me up front that she wasn't coming back to New York. The more months that went by without our getting closer to a pregnancy, the more aggressively I argued for living together. And the more aggressively I argued, the flightier the Californian became, until I felt I had no choice but to issue an ultimatum, which resulted in a breakup. And then a more final ultimatum, which resulted in a more final breakup. And then a final, final ultimatum, which resulted in a final, final breakup. Shortly after which, I went out walking along the lake in Lower Central Park and saw a male and a female mallard swimming side by side, nosing in the weeds together, and burst into tears. It wasn't until a year or more later, after the Californian had changed her mind and come to New York, that I faced medical facts and admitted to myself that we weren't just going to up and have a baby. And even then I thought, Our domestic life is good right now, but if I ever feel like trying a different life with somebody else, I'll have a ready-made escape route from my current one. Didn't I always say I wanted children? Only after I turned 44, which was my father's age when I was born, did I get around to wondering why, if I was so keen to have kids, I'd chosen to pursue a woman whose indifference to the prospect had been clear from the beginning. Was it possible that I only wanted kids with this one particular person because I loved her? It was apparent in any case that my wish for kids had become non-transferable. I was not Henry VIII. It wasn't as if I found fertility a lovable personality trait or a promising foundation for a lifetime of great conversation. On the contrary, I seemed to meet a lot of very boring, fertile people. Finally, sadly, around Christmas time, I came to the conclusion that my ready-made escape route had disappeared. I might find some other route later, but this route was no more. For a while in the Californian's cabin, I was able to take seasonal comfort in stupefying amounts of aquavit, champagne, and vodka. But then it was New Year's, and I faced the question of what to do with myself for the next 30 childless years. And the next morning I got up early and went looking for the Eurasian widgeon that had been reported in South Santa Cruz County. Thanks.
So I thought I would start off with a couple of questions and then we'll open it up to the audience, and I will reserve the right to come back in with additional questions. Gosh, where to start? First of all, thank you for that lovely reading. I wanted to ask you, in an essay on How to Be Alone about your father, My Father's Brain, you say, "My father was an intensely private person, and privacy for him had the connotation of keeping the shameful content of one's interior life out of public sight." And you seem in this book and in the previous essays to have made a point of making the private very public. And I wonder if that's ever uncomfortable for you in any way.
Well, the title of the new book is The Discomfort Zone. Which to some extent refers to the book itself. Refers to the fact of contemplating and then actually publishing something that could be construed as a memoir. No, the whole thing makes me incredibly uncomfortable.
And yet,
it's in my genetics to be
and
horrified
that,
with myself.
Is that the point, though, to seek out that which makes you the most uncomfortable, and that's what you write about?
Almost. I started doing those essays mostly for the New Yorker in the late '90s, and. Mm-hmm. My editor there, Henry Finder, called up one day and said, "Would you like to write about cigarettes?" And I said, "That's the last thing in the world I want to write about." And he said, "Therefore, you must write about it," which has been sort of a rallying cry. I think I'm a fundamentally lazy person, and I'm easily distracted. I think I'm a really good candidate for Ritalin, but I'm afraid I would love it so much that it would be just somehow the end of me. I did smoke cigarettes for 20 years, and that helped. But I've been off those for some years now, too. This is my way of saying there has to be some treasure at the end of the hunt. There has to be some hidden thing to make the writing seem worth doing. Mm-hmm. If the subject doesn't have the... If my response to thinking about the subject isn't initially... it's kind of not worth writing about. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I enjoy inflicting discomfort on other people. I want to try to entertain people in the way I like to be entertained myself. But it's a ready-made challenge. If I know it's something I don't want to write about fundamentally, that I would rather keep private, then there's a built-in, really exciting challenge to find a way to make it something you'd want to read. And also that means there's something to learn there. And I have a somewhat therapeutic bias underlying a lot of this stuff. Not that I think I'm ever going to get better, because it's really quite remarkable to feel as if you're fixing problem after problem, and yet you still feel exactly as bad in exactly the same kind of ways as before. Even though you can sort of sit back in a chair and look at all the progress you've made on all those fronts. So it's not like I think there's a cure, But the notion of actually trying to feel less bad about something by removing it from a sort of private, obsessive, neurotic realm and taking it into maybe a more cartoonish or comic or tragic or literary realm, I'm very attached to that.
And with this essay, what was the starting point? You mentioned before you started that you were thinking about global warming, dissolving marriage, elitism, birdwatching. What was the starting point?
That.
All of it. All of it together at once.
You know, I feel like I was married to a wonderful person, but we got married really young, and it was a really hard thing to talk about. I was ashamed of having had such a weird marriage, and I thought, no one has ever had as weird a marriage as I have. I'm sure it's not true, but I still think it's a low number of people who have. Whenever I would try to think about, well, maybe I should write some fiction about this, it was just like, no, this is just hopelessly specific, and there's just... And I was embarrassed, too. I mean, you're embarrassed by... Well, not even to get into why I was embarrassed, but... And then the environment is such an incredibly embarrassing thing to try to write about because you end up sounding so pompous and, you know, it's the fate of the earth. You know, and whenever you have the fate of the earth, you're kind of dead on the page. It's... Yes, I heard that already. I know about the fate of the earth. Now, can we have some fun? And yet you don't want to just have fun because, in fact, it is the fate of the earth. So there was that problem, the intrinsic embarrassment of trying to be sincere about something I cared about, like the fate of the earth. And then there was the fact that I didn't really feel like writing either of those things. I just wanted to be out with binoculars birdwatching, which itself was deeply shameful, and so much so that I, like, hide my binoculars in the park. And look, you know, it's sort of a little... kit bag or something.
But isn't the park filled with bird watchers? Didn't you run into countless bird watchers?
Yeah, and I wondered why they weren't more ashamed of themselves. Yeah,
too.
Exactly.
At the end of
don't
this...
you know how ridiculous you look? I do.
At the end of this essay, you write about the plovers, and they say they remind you of the human beings I loved best, the ones who didn't fit in. And I wanted to ask you about that in connection with a conversation that a group of writers had last weekend, and your name came up and your experience with the success of the corrections and audience and the question of entertainment. And one of the writers said, as a writer, I'm used to being in opposition to the world. When the world agrees with you, it's an uncomfortable thing. And they mentioned that and then went on to talk about, in some way, not wanting a big audience, wanting that there were a lot of people he didn't want to read his work, and somehow he I think wanted to hold on to that opposition to the world. And I just wonder how you sort of negotiated that with the way your career has changed since the corrections, if that makes any sense.
That's a lot of people in Europe take that view that you know you're doing something right if no one wants to read you. Mm-hmm. And I the whole thing confuses me a little bit because, like, if you sell monstrously well for a serious writer, you might sell maybe a million copies of your book, which is so, like, one out of every 150 American adults has bought your book, and maybe another one. It's tiny. The most successful you can be is still to be, you know, a little peanut next to the giant of pro football or the giant of mainstream television. So
you still feel
the numbers are enormous. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you try to shake the hand of 10% of those 500,000 people, and it's a lot of people. It's as many as go out to see the Giants every Sunday in the fall. Needless to say. It's football. They only play in the fall. Just trying to make a little joke there. I'm evading the point a little bit. The notion you would want someone not to read you is totally alien to me.
But then the notion of like with the success, sort of it shifts that your relationship to the world and this notion of no longer fitting in.
Oh.
And that somehow the success changes that in some way now you do fit in.
I know, but the way my anxiety goes, it always has to have some grist. And it's like, why don't I feel like a person who's had all this success should feel? everyone else who seemed like Ian McEwan, boy, does he seem, he seems like relatively comfortable, like he was expecting this somehow. And you spend hours sort of like, well, McEwan seems to be doing much better with this. I'm just this kind of weird, you know, former science nerd fraud who found his way into this and will soon be found out. So, I mean, there are all sorts of psychological dodges as far as that goes. But partly, I mean, the new book is an answer to that as well. It is acutely uncomfortable, not because I enjoyed the fact that no bookstores carried my first two novels and that, like, once a year did I ever meet someone, maybe at a reading of somebody else's, mm-hmm. who'd like heard of one of my books. You know, it's nice not to have, it's not, I enjoy actually attention. Where were we? No, so it's I'm to be nostalgic for marginality, I'm still marginal. I feel ever more marginal. I mean, don't you?
Well, I
mean, I watch the Oscars and I've actually relaxed to the point where I don't like have to hate all those people because I now realize just how enormous the gulf is between, you know, Toni Morrison and Philip Roth and Cameron Diaz. I mean. You know, it's Philip Roth and Toni Morrison, and then Cameron Diaz. It's like, how marginal can you get? By the way, for those, this is a podcast. I was actually using a visual there to sort of 1-inch tall literary figures and foot and a half tall star of Something About Mary. A great movie, by the way, which I've seen many times.
Maybe we'll open it up to the audience for questions following that.
And pray God there was at least anyone? One question. Yes. Yes, someone here. And should she shout it out or should I repeat it?
Yes, you should repeat it. That okay. would be wonderful.
How do you build an audience for a book?
Can it be done?
Oh, clearly it can. The question, how do you build an audience for a book? I have a prejudice toward actually trying to make it good, so it's sort of a quality prejudice. It is hopelessly idealistic, and yet it remains a conviction of mine that if you write enough good things, someone will eventually start noticing, and that they'll find their way to other good things that you might have written, and maybe even to your friends who are also doing good things if they are. You know, there's still the great thing about this country, and I think the reason so many European writers despair and take refuge, take satisfaction in being impenetrable. We don't have that as an option because there's this sort of pro forma bashing of anything that smacks of elitism. But also, those are smaller countries, and you know, to get like half of 1% of the population interested in your book. And there's a weirdo, you know, you take any group of 200 Americans, and there's a weirdo in there who you might have some chance of interesting in almost anything. I think the audience is, because there are so many of us, and it's a big pluralistic country, there is an audience for a lot of stuff, whether it's really weird, you know, three drummers and one guitar kind of music, or Bill Volman, you know, William T. Volman, who was here last night, I think, or somewhere in the neighborhood here. It gets into a longer and, I fear, not terribly interesting kind of process question about how books are selected and marketed.
But that seems to be something that you seem to take fairly seriously in terms of recommending your fellow writers, whether it's Paula Fox's Desperate Characters or Donald Antrim or David Means. Is that something that's important to you?
I just find it hard to find books that I think are really good, and mm-hmm. so I'm always really grateful when someone... I dated somebody in the mid-90s for about 7 weeks, and we didn't have a very good time at all, but she recommended to me both Haldor Laxness's Independent People and Kinsabra Oe's A Personal Matter, which are life-changingly good books. Run out and buy them. They're life-changingly good. I don't know anyone who would think they're not. I mean, truly, you can disagree about all sorts of people, but these are just really great books. In a way, that's all I would want to talk about if I could get away with it in an interview like this, is just try to passionately... You should take a look. Why didn't more people talk about In Persuasion Nation, which is just like, you know, George Saunders is Mark Twain reincarnated. And a little book by Rebecca Lee called The City is a Rising Tide, really, you know, completely overlooked, probably sold 700 copies. So I don't know how you build an audience for that book. But,
and how did you come across that book?
She actually was a friend of this person I dated for 7 weeks.
Some friend.
And so I ended up getting a manuscript, and I read the first paragraph, and I didn't think it was very good. And then the Californian picked it up and read the whole thing and said, no, the first paragraph's terrible, but read the rest. So that's how, you know, that worked. And Peter Carey's novel, Theft, fantastic book. Why isn't anyone talking about that? I think partly because it got... Well, I won't go into that. So it's, I think just keep, I really think a vibrant core such as one has here in Brooklyn and in the Bay Area and other less well-known places, I think a group of people, you know, reading each other's work and going to readings, and that helps too. I think having some sense that it's not a purely virtual community, that there are actual flesh and blood people producing these works. That all helps. I'm drifting off. Did I answer your question?
Yes, yes,
okay.
You did. Yes?
We're getting some very close to the front row questions.
New York Times not long ago shifted.
The question is about the proportion of nonfiction to fiction in the New York Times Book Review. And whether that's symptomatic. Yeah, I mean, it got really, really bleak in the mid-90s. They were doing like 2 fiction titles a week and 25 nonfiction sometimes, 4 titles a week. It got very bleak. In contrast to just 20 years earlier, as late as the 60s, it was 1-to-1, the ratio. It's an open question whether there really are that many great books that it's a terrible tragedy if they're not reviewed, written, published in any year, and if more people feel like writing memoir and are going to Africa and doing reporting there than feel like writing novels, is it symptomatic? This is such a, I mean, I've thought so much about this question, I'm kind of plunging in late and trying to do something deft, and now I'm realizing I'm just sounding like an idiot. Bridget has some powerful feelings and thoughts about this.
Well, I was actually curious.
I take it from your question that you're unhappy with that shift, or not? Maybe you're actually delighted with it, and you would like to see a poor novelist squirm when presented with these facts.
No comment.
It's gotten a lot harder to believe in fiction. You're bombarded with all of this literal information, and there are all of these alternatives to fiction that didn't exist 20, 30, 60, and 100 years ago. You know, movies, for instance, have been invented. It's become a rather successful medium. A lot of the talent that would have in the 19th century gone into being Disraeli or Dickens, why wouldn't you want to be David O. Russell instead, if you could? But we're not really doing justice to this question.
It's a big question, I think.
It's a huge question to answer.
Right,
that's why I was trying to do something deft. Deftness may still descend upon me.
Did you make a decision? I mean, it's been 6 years since the corrections?
5.
And a half? Will there be another?
Soon 5.5 years.
Jonathan Franzen novel?
Yes, yes.
So you haven't totally abandoned it?
No. In fact, no, I felt like a traitor to the cause when I started writing any nonfiction back in the 90s. I still have a desperate partisanship for the novel, but I can't make myself love something that I don't think is all that great simply because I'm desperately loyal to the form. So if all future fiction production or long fiction production were to cease and all the good writing was nonfiction, I would feel a real sadness. It wouldn't probably take anything away from my continuing relationship with the books already written. I would feel sadness, but I don't think there's a moral superiority to fiction. I think that there are things the novel can do that nothing else can and probably never will. And the real sadness, if people were to stop reading novels altogether or producing novels altogether or stop being able to read them, the sadness would be that some dimension of human experience that we had with us for many centuries was essentially becoming moribund and disappearing. And that's sad. If you happen to be centrally involved, I mean, like, if that's a central part of your own sense of who you are, that's a sadness. But this is the century of extinctions we're living in. It's all, most of them are ahead of us, but by the end of this century, things that one could be even sadder about will be extinct than fiction. And it seems, you know, it's really hard to do fiction. And it's hard because you're so bombarded with stuff and you feel like as you surf and as you, if you're like me, still read the newspaper, you're synthesizing all of this in your head and you feel like, God, wouldn't it be great to get all of what I'm feeling and experiencing about the world in those 400 pages? Why can't somebody do that? But for me, I am working on a novel. I will publish it, maybe even fairly soon. It's not enough to believe in the form. It's not enough to be smart about what's going on in the world. It's not enough to know how to do it. You really have to have something to say. And most of the best fiction writers I know, many of them, I mean, and I tend to be friends with people whose work I really love, most of them are struggling with the same thing, which is just a difficulty in knowing what to say as another 90 Iraqis are slaughtered. And you can trace it all the way back, and you can, it's a neat little link of connections to Scooter Libby. And you can do those connections in any number of other directions. And all of that stuff is just so readily available and so vivid and so fleeting. It's really, really hard to pin down. And I think we're in a very, just 2 years ago, it seemed inconceivable that we would have both houses of Congress in the hands of the Democratic Party now. And the White House is discovering just how unpleasant that is for a Republican White House. It seemed as if we were looking at end times politically. Karl Rove had figured out a way to permanently enrage half the country and have his way. And imagine yourself committing yourself to writing about that incredibly important revelation that has descended upon you about the end of political discourse, the ruination of the republic, if you're politically that way. And then to have, in fact, Katrina came along, and next thing you knew, we'd taken back both houses of Congress, and the administration is in the muck and is unraveling further. And it's like, whoa, I forgot to account for that possibility. So in some sense, one feels more alive than ever and more connected to stuff than ever, and at the center, more stupid and inarticulate and inability to just connect two thoughts in the simplest manner and fashion some simple, morally consistent narrative. It's a weird thing. It really feels like the best of times and the worst of times. I have hope that it's going to all produce great fiction in another couple of years. We may just be in a transitional time.
Any questions from the... Yes?
The fundamental source of my resistance to the Oprah selection... I didn't actually have... this is in the context of my liking readers and liking an audience. I didn't have any resistance. I went out and celebrated when I got the news. I had a resistance to the packaging of the writer, and I had a resistance to... Honestly, and it's not at all flattering of myself to admit this, TV's very big. And TV personalities are very big, and they have a way of being a little high-handed. And you really are nobody as a fiction writer in this world, but you do, in the privacy of your room at your desk, have to think of yourself as being the center of it all. stuff is going through you, you because otherwise you don't have the confidence to do anything. You have to believe that you've really, that your subjectivity is a big deal. And the way that that whole mess looks to me now, it really was sort of, it was more about a clash of two egos than it was about anything else. There was all this sort of ridiculous nonsense that was larded on about populism and elitism. I mean, that's stuff that I was trying to do the same thing that Oprah tries to do, which is write a book for everybody, something that actually would hold up if you read hard stuff, but also had some kind of inviting quality for people who just wanted a good story. So there was no resistance at that level. It really was more my feelings were hurt and then her feelings were hurt. The phoniness of the process of making TV, it's like all you've got if you're an indie band or a novelist is some sort of notion of your own integrity. And the way in which you check that at the door within half an hour, literally, of your selection for one of these book clubs, and just this massive machinery. I mean, I was faxing stuff to Harpo lawyers at 1 a.m. of the day that, you know, faxed, like making all these huge decisions at 1 a.m. of the very day that I'd gotten the call. And it just didn't sit well with me. I behaved badly. And then it was a bad time in this country. You know, it was the fall of 2001, so tempers were short. I don't know. Does that satisfy, or is there some... why my feelings were hurt? Why my feelings were hurt? There was an expectation that I would be monstrously grateful. I had a book I'd worked like 9 years on the book. It was a hardcover, unusual for a book like that to be selected. And it had just arrived on the bestseller list, fairly far up. And everyone kept saying, aren't you grateful? Aren't you grateful? Well, didn't they ask her? Aren't you grateful to have this nice book that you can actually all sit around and read? It's not like, my son doesn't rise over selling an extra 500,000 copies. You know, that's not what I was about. That's not what I was in it for. And so this sort of drumming of you're not grateful enough, and the sort of, you know, things would be offered, and then there would be sort of a hush as it's time for me to be grateful, and it was like, I'll be grateful. It's the Midwest. You be grateful too. I mean, I'm hanging myself with all of these responses, obviously, but you know, an individual confronting the corporate might of that outfit, and they are used to getting their way, kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Shouldn't have, but... Well, oh. No, thanks.
Maybe that's a nice place to end it. I think,
thank you very much.
There are books to sign over here, and maybe time for some additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.